The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 267 for Wednesday, March 30th, 2011. My name is Jules Cheesek. I'm in California with Jim Race. I'm in the California.
What an odd meme, or at least it's our own little odd meme.
Right, right. It's catchy.
Yeah, I feel very bizarre about that, but every time it pops into my head, I just kind of have to say it. But we're in the California, and apparently there was a race that happened this last weekend in the Europe.
That's right, in Donington.
Yeah.
Which was great to see, because Donington is it's a fantastic racetrack.
Yes, it is.
I do miss it off the MotoGP calendar, obviously, but now that Superbikes are there, cool. Okay, so this week we had... Jim, why don't you finish your damn contest?
I could do that. My completely oddball and and you put it so well, so self-serving contest. and I actually take that with a to heart now, because the question was on Facebook Motopod fan page. We had a question which was, what are the top 10 countries in people, you know, if you were to break it down from the 5,000 plus that are there, that actually are subscribers to the Motopod fan page? And you and I both knew that it was something that was a little bit surprising, but we got very few answers. because I think some people either thought it was obvious or nobody really gave a crap. But the shorter answer is we did get a few, and Jules, I believe you are the one that called this.
Blame me.
I am. I'm going to say, okay, this is all Jules' fault. Angie, Scooter Girl NZ called out and got closest, not even close, frankly, but close enough to win the calendar. So. And I know you listen every week because you send me very nice little missives on Twitter. So congratulations. You have won the final MotoMatters.com calendar as put out by David Emmett and Scott Jones, who was on last week. And it's not even April yet. So congratulations. You still have 3/4 of the year to go. I need you to send me an email to Motopod at motopodcast.com, your email address, or not email, I already know that because you would have sent me an email, but your mailing address, and I will get that out to you ASAP. And actually, Ed, I know I also owe you a calendar too, because that one bounced back. Jules, I am never doing fulfillment ever again. I'm horrible at it.
I can take care of Ed's if you send it to me, because I'll be seeing him in a few weeks.
You'll hand deliver it? Okay.
Okay, so... And Andrew, congratulations. You were completely wrong, but you were the closest out of the three ants that we got. So I actually want to go through this list, because this really is amazing. The number one country – this is Facebook statistics, so it's based on IPs of visitors. So it's using geo-IP tagging.
You're a geek.
Yeah, and while that may not be very accurate in a local area, it definitely is when it comes to countries. So these are really quite astounding stats, because the number one country is Italy, not the U.S. And then it's the U.S., then it's Portugal, Spain. See, Italy and Portugal and Spain make me think, yeah, people who like motorcycle racing, they just sign up for every Facebook page that has, you know, MotoGP or World Superbikes or anything like that. Then it's the United Kingdom, Indonesia.
But you know, interestingly enough about Indonesia, early on, that was the number one country. Actually, it's the number one city. I believe Jakarta is the number one city.
Not anymore. It's Rome, Lisbon.
Oh, well.
Lisbon and then Jakarta.
It's all very surprising, isn't it?
It is. It is. Okay. Then the Czech Republic, France, Australia, and Polska.
Yes. Poland. And if we wander down through there, we've got...
I love the 12th one.
What's that, Isle of Man?
Yeah, Isle of Man.
Sweet.
Yeah.
That's very cool, actually, if you think about it.
I totally love it.
Let's talk about other stuff.
Yes. Well, you've got some interviews lined up. Very excited to hear those.
I do. And we'll kind of pop through these in a logical order, which is unusual for Motopod. And many thanks to Donna Marie Paradis. But I got an interview with Robbie Ruffo, who I've wanted to actually talk to for a long time. And I thought it was pretty cool. Got a chance to run back through some of his history.
And, like, I mean, because we were talking about that, you know, I don't know, a few months ago about what a history he has in pretty much every class that's out there, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And I know you haven't heard that yet. Also did an interview with his team principal, Lucio Pedercini, who has a even farther back background. And as it turns out, just in that chat, and then I popped through some pictures, and I'll see if I can't post those. Well, I know there's two more that I don't have, or at least are on negatives. I can't scan them yet. I originally met him in 93 at Laguna Seca. And then I managed to talk to James Witham on Sunday afternoon after the races, and he and I wander through and discourse about everything that happened that day. So that was why I was hoping you could listen to it, Jules, because you and I will probably tread over much of the same ground, but it doesn't matter because our perspectives are quite different. but it was really fun to talk to him, and many thanks to James for giving me the time. And I should mention that the Foggy Wit tour is back on again for you folks in the UK, and I think in the UK and maybe getting over to the mainland and bouncing around. Who knows where they're going to go, but I think it's foggyandwit.co.uk. I'll confirm that and get it in the show notes. Those two again. And I have been poking at Carl Fogarty's manager to perhaps, and this is a long shot, but those of you, and I know there's a ton of you in the UK, and maybe some of you are coming over to the US, and I know there's a ton of you people in the US listening to the show, www.foggyandwit.co.uk. Send in suggestions, as I made the suggestion myself, and it was received in interesting fashion, to bring those two to the USA round of World Superbike at Miller Motorsports Park, and we will fill up a pub and have those two.
Oh, man, dude, that is so cool.
Blathering away, and I might even intro them and maybe even throw a couple of questions or at least get in a fight with Carl. So if you're interested, trace that down. I believe the gentleman's name is Brad that is Carl's manager. I'm giving away everything. If you're interested, let us try and make that happen. It may not. It's a long shot, but it would be fun, wouldn't it?
It would be amazing.
I don't think they know over there how much interest is here, especially with that kind of targeted demographic.
I mean, how desperate we are.
Well, no, but I mean, if you throw those two into a cool pub.
Of course. It'd be fantastic.
In Salt Lake, when you've got, you know, 25,000 hardcore World Superbike fans there, you'd fill the joint big time.
Oh, yeah.
And there'd be bottles throwing and knife fights and, you know, special underwear being shown. I don't know. Hello, this is Jim Race for Motopod. I've got on the line with me Robbie Ruffo. Robbie has been in the paddock and various paddocks for many years, starting back in 1998 or so when he first joined the world scene. He was racing Italian and Spanish national championships before that, Robbie?
Yes. Hello to everybody. The first year in 1998 was my first year of world championship in 250 class. Before I raced in 250 Italian championship and some races of European championship in 1995, 1996.
Cool. And you had a very successful run, although it took a bit, in 250 GP, culminating, I believe, was it 2002 or 2003?
Yes, the best year of 250 class for me were from 2001 to 2003, where I did four in 2001, and then position three in 2002, and second in 2003, and were my best season.
Yeah, in 2003, your 2003 year, if I remember correctly, you actually, that was down to the wire. That was a close finish, last race, right?
Yes, we were very close, me and Poggiali. I was fighting to win the championship, only 7 points from me to him. I was second before the last race, and I tried to fight, but unfortunately a problem on the electric part of the bike. I was unable to compete to try to be the first in the world championship, but this is the path.
Yeah, indeed. And then after that, you moved on. You actually switched up to MotoGP riding for the Satellite Dantin team. And you know, those were kind of older bikes with not the best tires. That must have been a bit of a struggle.
2005 was a little bit complicated here for me because I had the chance to ride a MotoGP bike. The Ducati was good, but was a little bit complicated bike because it was the 204 bike, and in this moment was the most complicated one. The down tire at the moment, the period where the first experience in MotoGP class, and we had a lot of problems. Then sure, the level in general of the package I had was not perfect to be on the top 10, sure. But I did some races. I was staying in some good races. I was staying in Donington. I was good and was staying also in Laguna Seca before the fuel was finished during the last lap. It was a very good experience for me.
I actually remember you running out of fuel on the last lap at Laguna, and that was a shame. So after that, you switched over to Superbike World Championship, where you are back in now, and you kind of bounced around there a bit. Give me a quick rundown of what you did there in the past.
After the 2005 year in MotoGP, it was not possible for me to continue in the MotoGP class. Then in the last moment in February, just before the first race start, I chose the solution with a completely private Ducati bike and Superbike. And I tried to do something good for from 2006 to 2008 in the World Superbike. And my good chance, my only good chance was to ride a factory on the bike in 2007 with the Tenkate team, where I was seven at the end of the championship. It was not so good year for me. It was not so bad year for me. It was good. Sure, in the period I want to be on the podium, but unfortunately, the same as Laguna, the fuel finish in Monza can be the first podium of my career in Superbike. But at the end, I was seven in the championship and was very, very good experience also that one. Then I had to stop in 2009 because the Superbike team where I rode finished the money, and I tried to go back to the GP where I was last year in 2010 in the Moto2 class. It was a good and successful year for me.
Absolutely. And very quickly in 2009, were you kind of dealing with some lingering injuries when you were with Stiggy?
Yeah. Before the season, I had a shoulder injury. And then I started the season, was not 100%. But the first two races I did with the Stiggy team, it were not bad during qualifying. Then we had some problem during the race, but maybe because team had some money problem. Then after the second race in Qatar, we had the team say to me that they need to stop with me. They chose another rider that has money sponsors. And then nothing. In 2009, I did two races of the Spanish Championship in Moto2 class, and I started to work on this category because I want to be back in 2010. And then 2009 was also successful because it was second in the race of the Spanish Championship and was positive for the debut in Moto2.
Sure. And then on to Moto2, and Moto2 was kind of a cool wake-up year for you. You managed to score at Sepang your first win in some time, huh?
Yeah, Sepang was a fantastic race. I was on the podium in Sachsenring in July. I was third. It's the place where I won my first race in 250 class, and was very, very good. And then I won in Malaysia in October, and was my first win in Moto2, and was very, very good sensation for me.
I bet. It's kind of like reliving your youth again. And so this year, and I have to say that it did surprise me a little bit that you've come back to World Superbike. You're riding for Team Pedercini for Lucio. And it's kind of interesting because I've watched the last I watched, of course, Phillip Island, and you struggled a bit in qualifying there and in free practice, but you did manage to do well in the races, 11th and 12th. But you're struggling again this weekend. Can you give me an idea what the issues are that you're facing?
Sorry. Sure. Yes. I decided to be back in Superbike with the Pedersini team. Lucio proposed to me to ride the new Kawasaki in the end of November, beginning of December, and we were very quick to arrive to the contract because I want to be back in Superbike and be competitive like I did in Moto2 before after after some years in Superbike. And nothing in Phillip Island. I'm really happy because I did a good two races, and sure were a little bit unexpected because the potential of the bike is good and the team is working very hard to set the bike that everything arrived on the last moment. The race were good. I was on point, and here in Donington is not too bad because I am very very close to the rider were in the super pole. Unfortunately, today was not so good a day for me because condition of the track was a lot worse this morning. As only three riders improved the lap time, and I tried something different on the bike, then was not so good, not the feeling as I want. And I have to understand also better where I can be faster with this bike, how I can and I must ride. And nothing today was not so good, but yesterday my lap time was not bad. Sure, position is not a position I want, but what is important is that we did a step in the front compared to Filipina, and then I hope soon to be in the Super Pole from Assen and fight also tomorrow in the race, be like Filipina, and this is my target for tomorrow. I hope with a good start to be there.
Yep. The good thing about it is tomorrow's weather, well, I hope this is good, is going to be similar to Friday when the lap times were much tighter, correct?
Yeah, can be. I heard about and I hope because today was not bad to do one lap, but with the modifier I did on the bike, was my feeling was worse. Then it was also day good for me to understand how I can improve on the bike and the track. Then for tomorrow can be better. I hope for a better weather, sure, because it's very cold at the moment.
Yeah, that's what I heard. I heard people were quite warm, T-shirts and shorts, and all of a sudden they're back to jackets and pants.
Yes, yeah, this is complicated. Also, with the leather that usually is hot, now it's cold. But I love hot weather, not cold weather.
Sure. What do you like the Donington Circuit?
Sorry?
Do you enjoy the Donington Circuit?
Yes, really. Donington is a track I always like very much from the 250 class because the track is fast in the first part, and this is very, very good for me. I love the fastest part. And only the last part is a little bit complicated because the rhythm is a change of rhythm. Then you have hard brake and slow corner, but with the superbike it's good because the bike has a really, really good acceleration.
Sure. What do you think of the slightly changed circuit as they've kind of widened out, I believe, the S's and maybe even Craner a little bit?
Yeah, the S's is better because it's a little bit faster. And I was talking before about the rhythm. Can help a little bit to have a better corner speed. I love more when the track is smooth and more fast to ride. Then the chicane is better, and in general the track is like as I left in 2008, but only the chicane is changed, which is good for me. I had a good feeling.
Good. What are do you have long term plans, or get through this season, get some good results, and do you want to stay in Superbike? Do you know where you want to be? Okay, cool.
Yeah, sure. I have already the answer. This is my target at the moment. I want to be competitive in this championship more than I was before, and like I was back in the GP Moto2 class, and I won a race. I want to to be on the podium in Superbike, sure, as soon as possible.
Absolutely. This is kind of a random question, but it did stick in my head. If you had to look at your Moto2 bike from last year and say your GP250 bike from 2003, how would you compare the two?
But the bikes are not so different in the way of work on the chassis of the bike, on the setting, because all the modify I can did in the 250 class, I can do also last year in the Moto2 bike. Then right. It's very, very similar, the bikes. Yeah, sure, the engine change. I love the two-stroke bike because I always like this sure. type of bike. Then,
yeah.
For the passion I have for the bikes, I have good memories of the 250. But I think Moto2 is a good category for young people also to adapt to a four-stroke and to arrive soon to ride well a MotoGP bike, for example.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, long-term racers and race fans absolutely love the two-strokes, and they are going to miss them terribly.
Because they did many years, and I like those very yep. much.
All right, Robbie, listen, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to Motopod, and I wish you the best of luck in tomorrow's races. Get a good night's sleep and go get them in the morning.
Thank you very much. See you soon. Bye.
All right, ciao.
Ciao, grazie, allora, ciao.
I want to just before, so we'll dive into the interviews in a sec, but I wanted to just very quickly, Martin talked about the race in Qatar last week, and I just wanted to throw in a little bit of my own opinion about something you guys were talking about, the Hondas and the gearbox thing.
Yeah, go for it.
Because everybody's talking about the upshift benefits, and then there was this great article that David Emmett did where he recorded the sound of the gearbox of the yep. different bikes going by and timed it and then figured out, it looked like about, 0.3 seconds a lap.
Did he ever release his data, the
yeah.
audio from it?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. He has it. He has it's fantastic. He's got the waveforms and everything. You can see it, but I started finding kind of like, upshifting is not, I don't think, is where the gearbox is helping because because there's that much less time during that you're shifting during, I mean, it's not like the other bikes are stopped, right? They're still moving forward. So you're not really losing the difference between the shift and on the Ducati and the shift on the Honda. You're not losing all that time because the bike is still moving. So that's, you can't just add those little snippets of time up and that's the difference, right? I think that watching the race, it seemed like those guys in the Hondas could shift pretty much any time. And that's the real benefit of this gearbox, is it doesn't unsettle the bike. It's so smooth.
Well, yeah, that's absolutely key because the box is already engaged. And so clearly, the trouble with an automatic transmission, or I'm sorry, a manual transmission, one of the reasons why an automatic transition is actually a little bit more comfortable, especially to your average person, is that it tends to not unsettle the vehicle. When you're cranked over and using maybe 5% of the tire and pretty much are on the edge, yeah, these guys have the opportunity to actually pull an upshift off without having to stand the bike up, and that's key. So it's essentially allows you to short shift without, losing the benefit without short shifting in reality. So you're actually maintaining the revs that you had before, and you don't have to get up on the fat part of the tire as early. And I think that's the key: getting out of the corners early. Being able to, as you say, not upset the bike, and as well as going into, say, you're going through not a chicane but a quick right left, maybe a 50 yard dash, where you really have to be able to set up for the next corner. It's clear that that's what the transmission is excelling at, and there's no doubt that people are going to be catching up quick style to this thing. In fact, everybody has said so, and I wouldn't be surprised if next year all of whatever the bikes that these things morph into have them.
I think I think it's great. This is the kind of technology I want to see, you know, trickle down.
Oh yeah, great!
It totally could, right?
Oh, it will, absolutely. Yeah. It already has. In fact, it's trickling up, to be frank, because it exists on Hondas already, Honda motorcycles already.
Oh no, that's right. That's true.
Yeah.
All right. Anyways, that was just because I was listening to the show earlier, and I was like, oh yeah, that's right. World Superbikes, Dunnington.
Cool. UK.
What a great track.
And, you know, a very interesting kind of weekend ahead in that. They had great, great weather, I think on Wednesday and Thursday, Friday as well. And, you know, people are talking T-shirts and shorts. And I'm kind of chuckling because we were sitting here in California freezing our nuts off with and, you know, I'm getting snowed out of work and and, you know, at 3,000 feet, no less.
Right.
And I'm like, you bastards over there, you know. It's the March race at Donington. Everybody's always moaning that, you know, oh, you know, it's going to be shit weather. And then come Saturday, they indeed got kind of stropped with that. And, you know, Saturday's kind of key because that's qualification day when people are actually trying to put down fast laps and taking all the things that they've learned from Friday and putting them to what is supposed to be good use. But everybody got, in a way, screwed. Granted, the top guys on that you'd expect, well, and even some that weren't, managed to put together some great work. But qualifying was still a bit of a mishmash, and we had some trouble there as well.
Yeah, and I don't actually understand what the actual qualifying issue was. Because
it was cold. It was damp.
No. I thought you were talking about, you know, the issue.
Define the issue.
Oh, just a little bit slapping issue.
Oh, well, that was post QP.
No, I know. But something happened on the track, which it's very unclear.
Well, and we can certainly talk about that. All right. So
I know you and James talked about this, right?
We did. This is the handbags at dawn, the classic literary reference. But it was preceded by a couple of incidents that occurred on track. One on Friday, I believe, but the majority of them on Saturday during the cool day. And it was just a succession of people interacting with Max Biaggi on circuit. Friday, to be frank, no, Friday would be Jim explaining Friday. there was just near the end of, I guess it was QP1, which is the second round of that day, running into the end of the day, there was a get-together between Max Biaggi and Michele Fabrizio, in which apparently there was, who knows what happened, but they got together, Michele crashed, mildly personally damaged, the bike itself, however, was totaled in the Western sense of the word, 30 grand damage, you know, it's enough to write something off.
You know, this is the first time that I've actually heard like a quote of how much it actually cost to how much damage was done.
Well, yeah, 30K euros. So it's, I don't know, 50K US, but you know, that could be a foot peg and a, you know, some Marchesini front. And then on Saturday, maybe during QP2, I believe it was during QP2. In fact, this is definitely true. It was QP2, FP3. So there's two sessions before Super Pole. There were incidents with both Noriaki Haga as well as a more serious one that occurred with Marco Melandri. Well, and I say serious simply because there's history there. Apparently Max was tootling around on the racing line, and this is not unknown for Max Biaggi. And I have a really great quote from somebody on Facebook that I will requote, because one of the most astounding things that I actually heard and said everything in reference for me. But Max was balking other riders from a quick lap, and Marco Melandri, having history with Max Biaggi, and I can get into that in a bit, and we can, you know, run through that just very briefly, decided to do a little payback. And it wasn't anything major. He didn't stuff him, but he kind of balked him as in return, going into God, I hate how I forget the name of the corner, but it's this big, ugly pseudo hairpin that they added on.
Called the old hairpin?
No, it's the new one.
Melbourne Loop?
Melbourne Loop. Yeah. The Melbourne Loop. Okay. He went inside of him. He went a little wide, forced him out, ruined his lap, whatever. And so, you know, there's hand gesturing and whatnot. Well, at the end of Super Pole, because they all made it in, and Max Biaggi took a little jaunt up to Mark Melandri's paddock or pit box and gave him a couple of love taps, well documented on multiple cameras, and that turned into a viral media thing that kind of, in a way, was a bummer, not necessarily a bummer for what happened, because we all kind of like a good show, and those two have sparred in the past, but it kind of took away a lot of the other news that had been going on, because, you know, it was a great qualifying effort from a whole bunch of people, but it was still big news, and, you know, a pair of Italians going at it, and the backstory is a bit, you know, you go back to Assen in 2005 when there were battles there. If you've been paying attention, you guys already know, and you've seen all these things. Those two are never going to become roommates ever. Yeah. Or if they do, it just ain't going to happen. And it popped back out again, but the one thing that, I'm going to butcher this, but it really was a really good way to put this in perspective. And the bottom line is that somebody said that Marco likely feels of Max as if he is somebody else to be passed. Max is back in the mode of feeling like people should defer to him when he is out in a qualifying lap. And this is a horrible butchering of that, but the point being, especially people that he has sparred with in the past, and one such as Marco Melandri, that, you know, they're going to battle. Now, I actually saw comments, because this was a classic, Jules. I think you remember when Nicky Hayden was coming out of his pit box and Max Biaggi was coming in and basically took him out. Remember the two of them collecting each other?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and Nicky Hayden on Twitter, he's like, looks like Max is making more friends this weekend.
Did he really say that?
He did say that.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So it's clear there's a ton of people that have been paying attention, people obviously well within the racing world. And so it kind of ended up being the story of the weekend. But, you know, there was a bunch of good racing anyway, but we couldn't go through this show without talking about it. And I talked about it way more than you. And so if you have a rant or two you want to let loose, fire away.
Well, first of all, were you talking about Felix Gonzalez comment on Facebook? Is that the one?
Read it verbatim, please.
Okay, it says it probably has more to do with the idea that Marco looks at Max as just another rider to pass, while Max expects deference to the champ.
Yep.
Well said.
Very, very well said.
Yep. And anyway, so let's do qualifying.
Do you want to do qualifying?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you fire through it.
I mean, you know, like you said, it was the temperatures changed, so mm-hmm. all the free practice setups and stuff like that had to be tossed. I think it took a couple of riders by surprise, but you know, the guys we expected to be out front were out front. Carlos Checa was on pole, got the pole, followed by Haslam, who, by the way, is, I think, probably my, like, I think I already said this once after the Australia round. I'm totally rooting for him to, you know, be the first guy to win on the BMW and more, because clearly that bike is still having issues, because Troy Corser is no pushover and he's way down in the order, and Haslam is doing amazing things with this bike. I mean, he was in Super Bowl 3 last time. He was on the podium in Australia. He was second here in qualifying and did really well in the races. So the guy just, he can ride anything, you know, that the just goes to show just how much he had, that Suzuki must have sucked last year for him.
Well, you know, actually he had some good results early on in the year. And
well, that's what I mean. But I think it was despite the fact that Suzuki was just not competitive.
And that's my point is that he had a bike that wasn't competitive. He had a team that wasn't necessarily behind him as the year progressed. Mm-hmm. In this particular year, he had a team that had kind of some organizational issues at the beginning of the year, and he took it upon himself to provide great results to try and pull the team together. And I think it's working, and that's a testament to his work ethic as well as his talent. And
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think he's got the capability to keep doing that, and it's great to have a rider that can actually, you know, take a team that isn't basically gelling completely and be the catalyst that pulls them together.
I like it.
Yep.
Then Tom Sykes with that Kawasaki, you know, the ZX-10R is coming to, I don't know. Maybe it's Tom because Les Corse is having a little bit of trouble with it. But you say that,
and then look what happened in the races. And of course we'll jump ahead of ourselves.
Yeah,
I'm not going to let you get through qualifying without giving away.
I'm actually just going to run through it. This is Jakob Smirts always up there in qualifying because he's supposedly the one lap wonder. Although obviously that wasn't the case this week. Weekend, Haga, the first of the Aprilias, which is cool. Biaggi, Camier, and Jonathan Rea, and then blah, 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 some other guys.
Yeah, I give
Melandri in Super Bowl II, so.
I give Noria pata on the back.
A pata?
Yeah.
Right on. Wait, I don't know the reference. Sorry.
It's a pata racing team.
Oh, ha. You're cool. You're the card. All right, cool. So that was qualifying. And obviously the little run-ins with the Emperor.
Yeah, what a mess. What I will point out is that particular incident, and I should have said this before, actually set the tenor for race day.
Oh my God, that's my rant comes later because I think that what happened as a build-up with all that, and then Max getting fined 3,000 euros for his unsportsmanlike conduct, which is pretty weird, really, because most of the time you get those fines for, you know, doing stuff on track, right?
Yeah,
it's very rare that you get it because, and I think Martin emailed us saying he thinks maybe it was kind of like, well, it wasn't really sure. They weren't really were sure what to do about the stuff that happened on the track, but this was kind of like put it over the top. So they really were fining him for the stuff that was happening on track.
No, they were fining him for being a dick in public.
Okay, I like that. Let's not mince words. The guy was dick in public.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's what it is. Cool.
I mean, seriously.
That's perfect. I love it. Yeah. I love it. No, nothing needs to be said beyond that.
All right. So the weather on Sunday was a little bit different for both races. The morning started off a little bit similar to, say, midday on Saturday. And so we had not necessarily cold conditions, but cool. Most of the riders actually opted for the harder tire, which is a little bit unusual considering that the temperatures were cool. The track was still cool. Very few actually went for the soft tires, a notable exception being Jakob Smirts.
Right.
And that proved to be very interesting and provided a lot of entertainment in the first race.
Yeah. Yeah. The first race, Jakob Smirts jumped up front pretty early on and he looked like a runaway.
Yeah.
He looked like what we were expecting from Checa, who did not have a good start. And was actually, by the end of the second lap, he was in 11th.
No doubt.
And the guys up front were Leon Haslam, Leon Camier, and Biaggi and Haga kind of were up there. Biaggi just kept making the Biaggi mistakes. I mean, you know, he's the guy that, even at his like favorite racetrack, I remember Brno last year, he was, you know, when we were watching, when my wife and I were watching the MotoGP race and at Qatar last weekend, and Spies was trying to pass Rossi at the end of the straight.
Biaggi move,
yeah, that's exactly what we were, I was saying. It's like, my God, why? How many Biaggis is he going to pull? You know, because that's the Biaggi's, you know, classic blunder.
Pull it back to, what was it, Portimao last year, the year before, when he was running on in turn one over and over and over again.
Yes, that's right. Exactly. Yeah.
And so, you know, you look at that and you've, in under normal circumstances, he would actually kind of pull that together again and pull himself back in, gather. But it actually got worse and worse and worse until he had some major blunders, you know, running across gravel, looking like he was going to come out back onto the circuit in front of other riders. And
he was going to spear Kamier if Kamier had been, you know, a little quicker through that chicane. Yeah. He obviously saw it happening, so he was ready.
At a certain point, I think I blurted out, I'm like, dude, just freaking park it. Park the thing.
Right. Yeah, it was pretty nasty.
But there was, Biaggi was not in a parking mood today.
No. He really was not, as we'll go in later. But anyway, so, but the big thing was that Melange was setting the killer lap times. And so was Cheka from 11th, you know. Melange started in 9th.
Meanwhile, the camera wasn't paying any attention to a gentleman we haven't seen running at the front for such a long time, that being Jakob Smirts.
Yeah. And when we did, it was because Melange was coming.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, Melange really timed it well, because it was the penultimate lap that he caught Jakob and then passed him and held him off, because Jakob was just... And afterwards, you know, they showed the tire on a Ducati and it was so trashed. Jakob's tire was completely trashed.
But, you know, that's the kind of thing that we've been seeing out of him year after year.
The bottom
line is that in the past, and I've been absolutely guilty of this, but I've always kind of wanted him to do it because the man's certainly a genuine personality and has a smile of gold. Jakob, if you are listening to this or any of your fans out there, Motopod salutes you, because you kicked ass this last weekend, and we were rooting for you to stand on the top step. I know I was. And granted, to see Marco come up and grab his first win in World Superbike was great, but well done, and a massive Motopod tip of that.
Yep, definitely. And a big one to Carlos Checa, who did manage to make it into the third spot. And he actually looked like if he had a lap or two more, he may have caught Kuba as well.
Yeah, I think he actually celebrated his 27th birthday this year. And I think he's going to be 26 in April. So he's working his way down again. Yeah. He'll be riding minis, I think, in probably 2014.
You know, what I really like about Checa, he's a very humble dude. I really just, his interviews, he's just such a chill dude.
Yeah, that'd be nice to see out of all the guys at the top step, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I'm a snarky bastard tonight, aren't I? In a very sort of casual way.
Yeah. So casual. Yeah, so that was the crux of race one. And I know you and James talked some more about it, so I want my... waste more time with it. Let's just jump to my favorite race of the day, race two. Actually, no, I really did enjoy race one. Race one was a great. Both races were good, but this one, race one, was fantastic. I loved seeing Melange win that. I loved seeing Kuba up there. Race two wasn't as surprising because Checa, even though he didn't have the greatest start, he had a better start. Who actually led? Was it? Yeah. Oh, Leon has him led again.
Yeah. He led both races off the bat.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that was not to stick all the way through. But
no. He had a little bit of an excursion that dropped him down to 7th or 8th, and he still fought his way back up to 4th. So
indeed.
Yep. So great again. Another fantastic job from Leon Haslam. Checa did eventually get up front, and then just started pulling away and was controlling the race. And I was thinking, you know, since he actually did switch to the softer tire for the second race. I was thinking this is going to be an interesting comparison between him and Kuba, because same bike, same tire. Was he going to have the same trouble? And if you looked in the Parc Fermé, that tire was just as trashed as Smertz's.
Yeah, but let me back you up. So you're saying Leon Haslam and Kuba Smertz?
No, sorry, Carlos Checa.
Oh yeah, okay. Well,
I said Carlos checked out, and then he controlled the pace up front. Melange did come looked like he was cutting the lead down, but Checa upped his pace again. But like I'm saying, like in Parc Fermé, when they had the same kind of shot. The camera went across. That tire was trashed. So I think that it wasn't tire management. It was just that Checa was able to ride around that problem.
Well, yeah, better. That's very true. That's very true. And he's always been a very smooth rider, sometimes to a detriment, because he'll choose a line and never err from it, even if somebody happens to be in his path.
Like at Valencia, for example.
Yeah. But still, it seems to work for him very well. There's no doubt that the softer tire is going to work well, much better for the Ducatis, especially at this circuit, because, you can get out of the corners on a relatively soft way. And the Ducatis currently have this really nice wallow that they're not necessarily spinning the tire up so bad. They just kind of wah. You can see it. It's almost rhythmic as they're pulling
off.
It's
true. And they actually had some great footage of the bikes going through the S's in slow motion, the rider comparison style thing. And you could totally see that on the Ducati. The Ducati was just like you say, basically like kind of bending into the corners.
It really is like a comfortable wallow. And I've actually experienced that. And those are much better than the ones. And you can see the guys on the fours, especially through like Craner curves. And they're struggling with the bike. They're having to force the bike to do what they want. And you don't have to do that with the Ducati, or at least Carlos and Jakob Smertz were not having to do that. The bikes, you could lay them over, they would be compliant. And the funnest thing on a bike on a road course is to let the bike do what it wants, as long as it gets you where you want to go. So just ride the bike as it wants to be ridden. That is not easy at, any pace, 80, 90, 100%. Let alone the 110 these guys are going at.
Oh, yeah.
When you can let it do that, that is the most fun. It's actually a really relaxing way to ride. And if you have the capability to give that much and the bike will give that much back to you, it makes almost for an easy race.
Yeah. I mean, that's like the thing you have to unlearn when you get yourself in trouble, is not to, do what your body wants to do, which is to grab on tight. Just let the bike figure it out,
Yeah, just close your eyes, dude. I'm telling you.
Well, isn't that what Rossi and Caparossi were saying in a couple years ago? Remember?
Yeah.
No, it was not in the movie. It was like during the 2005 season or something like that. They were joking about the fact that they, like Rossi was saying, he closes his eyes when he passes people and stuff. Anyway,
Hey, you know what? Remind me of this later, or you. Viewers, listeners, whatever, can remind me of, but there are some good movies coming out. There's TT3D coming out, which is supposed to be crazy good. We know there's Fastest coming out.
Yeah, Charged.
Yeah, Charged.
Charge, not Charged.
Well, it'll be charged once you're in the door, right?
Okay.
Move on.
you're going to Vegas, aren't you? All right, We forgot to actually talk about Laverty in the race one, but I guess you and James covered that. Did you guys cover Berger Maxime?
We did, and his
amazing wheel.
Torture. I believe the term that popped into my head, though I never said it, was the girlfriend that left him at the last minute.
Man, dude, that was the most insane thing I've ever seen.
It was a very interesting. Failure as it was, there were a lot of people at the time, including James and Jack and others in the paddock, that thought that essentially the wheel nut had failed.
Right. That's what I thought too.
Yeah, single-sided swing arm. But it hadn't, as it turns out. And a real
boost. By the way, that's like my biggest nightmare because both my bikes are single-sided swing arms. So when I saw that, I was like, oh, man.
Yeah, but you ride them like a girl. So, I mean, these guys are actually...
That's true.
Yeah. And I say that in the nicest of ways, miss. The odds are that this is a wheel that had been... It's a racing wheel, and these guys are riding these things hard. You know, you go over curbs, you crash them occasionally, and
yeah, and they said like the wheel is like 3 years old.
Well, then that certainly would contribute to its degradation. This is not entirely unusual amongst teams that are struggling with budgets and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Once you listen to James interview, you'll note that I kind of gave him the stick. I'm like, you never did anything like that back in your, you know, super sport days or anything, duct tape and baling wire. But, you know, teams sometimes have to reuse things. Now, wheels, perhaps not the best component. And certainly there's going to be a lot of teams that are running single-sided swing arms, be it, on the Ducati, or if there's people out there still running, you know, NC30s and such. But it's something to consider. And the nice thing was, and it probably would be of the usual nature in the future, that these things are going to happen on the slowest corners where you're using the most torque and the most side slip, you know, the most side grip. So the entire thing is kind of twisting. If you did, that would not probably happen under normal circumstances on a 200-mile-an-hour straight, although it could, of course, if it was damaged, but whatever. Certainly the danger is there. Mechanical failure is not uncommon.
Yeah. But it just was such a blatant, crazy, you know, failure. Well, it's weird to see something like that where the bike falls apart, basically.
Yeah, it was caught on camera. You know, it's like those old jokey TV commercials where, you know, you go up to kick the tire and all the fenders fall off.
Right.
Well, you know, it's a Ducati. I'm not sure what the – is that still in warranty? I don't know. and a lot of people have asked is what wheel was it? It was an Oz Racing wheel. People were speculating about the brand. No diss on Oz Racing. You know, it can happen with any wheel. And I'm sure there will be some investigation, people actually explaining. And I'm sure that they've probably taken that wheel, asked for it back, taken it back and magnafluxed it or put it under neutron radiography or whatever, trying to figure out where the failure points were. Are they going to be able to tell after a full failure? Who knows? The bottom line is that happened at the exit onto the front straight. He was not hurt. I believe it was Ayrton Badavidi behind him had a grandstand seat and was kind of wondering why it turned into a Can-Am. But it was a really weird thing and not something you see very often.
Yeah.
And pleasantly so. I can't even imagine that on some circuits. You know, the last time I remember like a big failure in a tire or wheel was that massive crash. Yes, actually, absolutely. Yeah. And the 400-yard tumble.
Yeah, 2004.
Yep.
Mugello.
Indeed.
Yeah. Yeah, that was crazy. That was crazy. Because that's the one where it was at top speed.
Yep. Yeah, he was probably doing a good 200 real miles an hour there. Not those wimpy 200K.
All right. Okay, back to race two. Carlos won. Melandri was second. Great day for Melandri. He actually managed to pull some points on Carlos in the championship, and is second now in the championship.
And who do you surpass?
I don't know, some other Italian guy. and Leon Camier, who I guess was sick or something.
Yeah, he had a bout of food poisoning and something else, some gastrointestinal thing that was well beyond gas and whatnot. I don't know the particulars of it, and we don't get much word from, and I'm kind of bummed about this, from Clinica Mobile. We used to get a lot of...
Yeah. I have their RSS feed in my reader, and it's very, very light this year so far. Yeah, let's talk about this other Italian guy. So at the start of the race, it was an incredibly obvious false start that Max Biaggi did.
Well, the big point is that it was and it wasn't. Yes, he definitely he basically left when the lights came on, but he also immediately got on the binders, stopped. He was about a yard beyond his pit box, and he waited until they went off before he went again. So
he actually didn't gain almost anything out of it. It's just like any other false start I've seen.
Yeah. But by the letter of the rules,
exactly,
it was a false start.
Right.
And he got the classic penalty for it. They reviewed it and they looked at it, and they gave him the meatball flag. And those meatball flags, dude, are not unobvious. And Max, bless your Roman little heart, but you don't miss those. And the claim was that he missed it by the end of the race.
Does he actually have the gall to say that afterwards?
Well, dude,
did he really say that?
Dude, he had a gallbladder infection all weekend.
he was definitely an ass all weekend. But
I did not see it. Bullshit.
could I be more clear?
He really said that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. You know, this is the thing that really pissed me off about the, because the other stuff about, you know, the little slap.
Your rant's
coming. No big deal. Here comes the rant. Here comes the rant. Okay. It's 1998 and he got black flagged Catalunya.
Mm-hmm.
He was racing against Doohan. And he got black flagged because he was supposed to do a right through because he passed under a yellow, and he basically ruined the rest of his season, because then he was pissed the rest of his season, and he could have been the first, you know, 250 champion to go immediately to the 500cc class and win, mm-hmm. you know, the championship. He was having an incredible season, but he didn't. That was a forgivable black flag, right? And he was still he still was kind of a dick about it. Now this time, he knew that he did a false start because he was shaking his head. Right, he goes, oh, you know, you could see him shaking his head. That's how much time passed, right? And then he's claiming that I even know this part that he wasn't claiming because he did eventually pull in, which means he saw the black flag. It's disrespect to the team that really pisses me off, right? You go out there, these guys are working for you. They're telling you get the fuck back in the pits. Do your ride through. It's going to cost you, you know, 20 seconds maybe to do the ride through. Haga fell off the freaking bike, you know, way out. I don't know what corner that is, but he was way off course.
I believe they call it left field.
Yeah, he was in left field, picked the bike up, and he kept going because there was always a chance he'll pick up a point. He didn't. But, that's what I love about Haga. He never freaking gives up, right? He got that bike back up. Put it back out on the track, and meanwhile, yeah, I don't know. You know, my rant is—it's just not worth it. It's just not worth it. I've already spent so much energy being pissed at him because he seems to have turned around that asshole Biaggi image that he had for so long in World Superbikes. The moment he became world champion, it's like he's just become an ass again.
Well, okay. He became an ass again in what, one race weekend?
He's an ass, dude. He's going to be an ass. he was an ass in Australia, you know. He was already he's privileged. He's acting like he's privileged.
Yeah, and you did say fool me once, shame on me. Fool me once, or fool me
yeah.
twice.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Max has fooled us about 3,000 times, and those of you that keep diving back and hanging from his chode might want to think about. Oops. Do we need to edit that out? Was that too explicit?
No, it's fine. It's fine. I mean, here's the thing. It's like I hate it when people jump on the bandwagon and stuff and talk about Biaggi being, you know, the bad guy during you know, many seasons where he's really trying, you know, to be fair to his team and all that kind of stuff, because that's what he did since 2007, but this is back to the old Biaggi, and it's unforgivable.
Which is fine, but I would have to say that he basically spent the last 2 years up until this point in World Superbike being pretty chill, and so
right,
and as a very and you got the I'm sh- I know that you got the graphic of this or the photo that I shot. But there's a few people who think that he's lost the plot, and I love that term.
Oh, yeah. I love it.
whether he can gather it back together again, and I'm sure he can, and frankly, hopefully...
hopefully he does, but you know what?
You don't
He's
give a
dead sh- to me. He's dead.
Yeah, unless he knocks your guy off.
Oh, man. I don't know. That was just stupid. It was stupid. It was selfish. I just hate seeing it. It's totally unsportsmanlike. Anyway, the good news is that some great racing happened, and
so if you know, you and I could talk about World Superbike, and frankly, we could only talk about World Superbike races for a little bit. But there's no doubt that we could talk about the personalities and probably get in a verbal fisticuffs before the evening is out. But that isn't the point. The point is to continue talking about racing. And in that vein, I had a lovely chat, and I mean that in the most manly of ways, with one James Whittam. And Whittam, thank you. All of my Euro friends are kicking my ass every time I say Whittam in the vein of Jorge Lorenzo. Anyway, I had a great chat with James, and I did it on Sunday evening, his time, which is very cool to be able to get his impressions after the races. And as usual, he and I wandered down the garden path and pretty much spent a lot of time making no sense, but apparently keeping you guys entertained. So listen to this and enjoy.
Okay, are you back home?
Yeah, just got home about half an hour ago. Yeah, it was not too bad getting out of sickie. Sometimes when they've got sort of 60, 70,000 at Donington, it's a nightmare. You don't bother setting off till sort of 3 or 4 hours after the race is finished. But today, they probably had about 25,000 people, so not so bad.
You put that down to the weather?
I don't really know. I mean, it's kind of average. The last couple of Grand Prix at Donington, they were down to sort of 25,000, 30,000. So I don't really know what it is. It was quite cold, and it had been cold leading up to it. Although quite fresh and bright, it had been cold. So you miss out on all the guys who'd set off on the bikes, you know. Where at Donington during the summer, you see 20,000 people on the bikes. But, you know, most people are in cars this kind of weather. So maybe the weather affected it, yeah.
Sure. All right. Well, just a quick introduction for folks out there in Motopod land. I am speaking with one James Whittam, who spent his day at Donington Park with Jack Burnicle and the rest of the crew, watching some very interesting racing, wasn't it?
Yeah, really good. We were really pleased with that. Because Donington's been laying idle now for a couple of seasons, and it was going to be all altered and made into a Formula One track. They dug some of it up, and it's been a real job for the new organisers down there to get it back to racing condition. And I was really pleased to see a good day's racing, some exciting racing, and a good weather, really, because, you know, March in the UK, you can really easily get either good or really bad.
Yeah, I think it was actually about a year ago when I first talked to you, and you issued the famous Donington, well, you got crap in a bucket, but it's a great place.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, the facilities for the spectators haven't really changed that much, and they haven't changed since maybe, you know, early 80s. So it is fairly basic compared to most world-class circuits now. But they've done a lot of safety work to the track, extended gravel traps, moved some barriers, and the place is as safe as what you'd find anywhere now. And always good racing, you know. It's a circuit that, you know, always gives a sort of incident. There's always a few people dropping off and a few, you know, it's one of those circuits that it's kind of old school, not designed on a drawing board, and it gives good racing.
Yeah, you know, and it does seem to me that the just slight modification they made to the S's there actually really cleaned that section of the circuit up.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, the S's first went in like 20 odd years ago just to make the circuit longer to be able to host World 500 Grand Prix as it was then, because it was less than 2 miles and they wanted a 2 mile plus. So they put that Melbourne loop in, and the S's, the one that became known as Foggy S's, was always a kind of stop start, lots of incidents. I remember Schwantz running in the back of Doohan, going over the top there. There's always lots of silly kind of shenanigans that was unnecessary, and I think they've sort of squared it up now.
Cool. Well, it was definitely good to see that race, and talk about one that had some anticipation leading into it. And maybe not for the right reasons, because we went through qualifying yesterday, and there's a lot of things that we should have been talking about, but there was one thing that was on everybody's lips, the talk of everything.
Yeah.
And in a way that was a bit of a damper, but, you know, it's always kind of good for the sport, some controversy. But that was just weird. And we're talking about Max Biaggi and Marco Melandri. Yeah.
It was really weird. I mean, the thing is, nobody could really understand it. I mean, Biaggi is a strange one. He's been quite good in recent weeks in that he's been very kind of, you know, self-effacing, and he's been able to find it in himself to give credit to other people. And we've just started to come round to him, and then this happens. And for no reason, we couldn't really understand in the Superbike paddock what had gone on. But it turns out that they've got a lot of history from MotoGP. That's absolutely where it's come from. And apparently something's happened in the last couple of years they raced together in MotoGP that has really got up the nose of the Roman Emperor. And even the on-track stuff, you saw Melandri coming on his quick lap, Kamiya got out of the way, and Biaggi just refused to get out of the way, and that was one thing. Then Melandri took offence to that and then chopped him back across his nose at the Melbourne Loop. And there was some on-track, you know, posturing and waving his hands. But what we couldn't believe is Biaggi's reaction went up to the Yamaha garage, and to give credit to Melandri, he smiled and he took it on the chin when he was getting shouted at, and he even took it on the chin when Biaggi slapped him a couple of times. And that's, you know, it's not, I mean, yeah, it's good for the sport in a way that it created a lot of interest and controversy, and some people like that, but just, no, I don't think, you know. And, you know, for a man of his calibre and an obvious talent, you know, you don't want to see that from Biaggi. And to be honest, if it hadn't been anybody else than Melandri, he could have got some teeth knocked out of there, I think.
You know, and I was trying to picture that occurring to a host of other riders, and I'm like, that could have really ended up being ugly.
Absolutely. And the thing is, with Biaggi, if it had gone ugly, he'd have been crying the poor tail and saying it was the other rider's fault for being aggressive, and you know, he'd have wanted sympathy. But there's no excuse for that kind of behaviour. It's just, whatever's happened in MotoGP, you know, it's not good.
Yep, and it seems like, you know, when our grey hairs come over from MotoGP and perform some outstanding racing in World Superbike, that they usually tend to don their more professional caps. So I think it was a surprise to everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just, I mean, I don't even care about that. You know, people say, oh, it's bringing the sport into dispute. No, I'm not really bothered about that. What really gets to me is, as an ex-rider, the fact that the kind of lack of respect there that you kind of take for granted, really, you know, that people respect each other. And, you know, and you don't have to like everybody, but, you know, you're all out there together. It's a dangerous sport, and you really got to look after each other. And that, to me, it's not part of a sport I didn't find like that. You know, I never found it to be a sport like that. You had a spat with somebody, maybe you had an on-track incident, and, you know, within a week, you'd sort it out. You didn't hang some Noah from three seasons ago in MotoGP. You know, it's pretty weird.
But that certainly did set up what a lot of people were kind of wondering might or might not happen on Sunday. And, you know, while there may have been a little bit of that, it seemed like whatever was in Max's head certainly continued. And let's talk a little bit about the races. And you know, qualifying was a great event, you know, with the exception perhaps of Eugene's troubles this weekend. And
yeah, I mean, Eugene, I mean, the thing is, he's the least likely rider in the paddock to do something like that. But having said that, I mean, I know from bitter experience, the Craner Curves section, there's not that many left-handers at Donington. Certainly, there's only two left-handers where you'll get any heat into your tyre. The rest are really slow. The chicane and Goddard are slow, so you don't get any heat in. And really, there's only Starkey's Bridge stroke Schwant section and Craner where you're actually doing any kind of side push on the left-hand side of the tyre. You don't expect Lovett to get caught out, although he's new to the class. He's just a clever, considered, and just a switched-on rider. But it was cold, and it was catching people out. The super sport practice about four were playing there. And, you know, it's not such an exclusive club that, you know, they reckon there's two kind of riders that's raced at Donington. There's those that have crashed at the bottom left-hander at Craner, and those that are going to do, because it's easy done. It will catch you out. But with the exception of that, we really enjoyed qualifying. We enjoyed Super Pole. Four Brits on the first two rows. We couldn't have asked for much more than that. We enjoyed it.
Certainly so. Yeah, you actually coined a term yesterday, which I hadn't heard, but I noticed it enough. It was the last thing I wrote before I caught a little nap this morning because I stayed up all night. Was the Craner Curves Club?
Yeah, it isn't. I mean, it used to be quite exclusive, but now bikes are so much quicker. You're really going down there, you know, and it's just so easy to do. Everything's going away from it. It's cold. The camber's bad. You flip it to that left-hand side of the tyre, lots of side push, and it's always quite early on in the session or the race because you can get it up to about four laps in if it's cold there because you just haven't got the heat into the left-hand side of the tyre. So, yeah, it's one of them corners where you feel to be going fairly quick when you sit on your bike, but when you're off your bike, it's just rapid. You just feel like you're going to go into orbit. It's a really quick corner.
Yeah, you said one thing that stuck in my head was you were talking about guys coming out for track days and whatnot, and they'll come through there thinking they're doing 50-something miles an hour when they're really doing 100. And yeah. they decide to run off into the grass thinking that's a safe place to go, and it is not.
Yeah, especially, you know, in March in Britain when it's been raining, the grass is, you know, you might as well just have an ice rink. And it always amazes me, the track day boys, a lot of them, will go into a corner maybe, you know, 5 miles an hour quicker than the brain can accept. And instead of leaning over a bit more and trusting the tyres and the bike, yeah, they elect to sit it up and head for the really slippy green stuff on the outside, you know, and then they're surprised when they've got a bent bike.
The obvious sign of somebody that's relatively new to the track is instead of trying to make the corner, they will just stand it up. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you see smoke coming off the rear tire. You're like, oh no, this isn't going to be good. all right. Race day dawned. It was a little bit chilly still in the morning, and that didn't necessarily bode well, but we knew we were going to have a good fight. And I don't want to walk through the whole race, but let's kind of, you know, talk about a few of the highlights. Obviously, Eugene going out early was one. I think the thing that shocked me right off the bat, though, was Smertz getting to the front and staying there. That's the word they were saying there.
We expect a lot from Smertz. We expect him to be first two rows, possibly front row. We don't expect him to have a race strategy and a race pace. He did have that. He fought to get to the front. We knew he was on a soft tyre, but at Donington, we knew it was also quite possible that one of the Ducatis or more may be able to make that soft rear or the softer of the options work and last, and he nearly got away with it. If it hadn't been for the fact that Malandri was absolutely bang on it. Whatever Malandri's done, I don't think the Yamaha was the quickest thing out there, probably as quick or a bit quicker than the Ducati, probably not as quick as, say, the Kawasaki or the Aprilia or the BM, but it just looked to be working so well at R1 for Malandri. Certainly down Craner, where you're going into the old hairpin, you're changing direction, you're still carrying a lot of brake, and he was so confident. All the passes he made on everybody, and there was a lot because they came through from way back, were all done on the brakes, you know, with confidence and clean, you know, no sort of running wide or nearly getting past. They were all clean. So, yeah, I mean, the highlight for me was Malandri getting to second, did have enough time to get back onto the back of Smertz and passing. By the time he did catch him, to be honest, the lap times were that it was obvious that with the confidence he had and the tyre he had left, he was going to take the win. And I was really pleased with him, particularly because all the sticky came on for him for MotoGP. Everybody wrote him off, and doubly because he'd been slapped in the face the day before by Badger.
Yeah, you know, the look on his face reminded me of Laguna, and just him getting on the box when he broke his legs, I believe his left leg, when he got hit by Curtis Roberts way back in the day. And he just had that smile like, son of a bitch, I can still do it. And I loved that.
Yeah, he did, yeah. And I don't, he's a good guy. We spent about 3 days with him at the bike show about 2 years ago. And he's a good bloke. He's a nice fella, self-effacing, doesn't sort of make too much noise, and a good bloke. And certainly, you know, if the bike's working that well for him, and the team's really professional, you know, he will go well pretty much everywhere, I think. The team's got the data from years with really good riders, so you know, he bodes fairly well for him. Other highlights in race one, not so much Haslam. He struggled, and you could tell he was struggling. So we felt a bit sorry for him. Tom Sykes looked like he was going to turn that front row start into a rostrum, but lost the front. Turns out afterwards we found out he was having lots of problems. The bike was perfect, really quick, good on the power, everything was working, except the clutch was tending, or the clutch stroke, corner entry aids were tending to push him into the corners. And he almost like a two-stroke, you know, not so much engine braking where he needed it. Yeah, he found himself.
That was a very weird looking crash, and as soon as we heard about the freewheeling, I'm like, oh, okay, that completely makes sense because I've run on, you know,
exactly,
get a fall.
In fact, I'm a little bit annoyed with myself for not spotting that, because he was still carrying brake mid corner, and you know he lost it in a place where you'd expect for him to lose it a little bit earlier than that if he was losing there, but. Yeah, lots of problems with the clutch, as it turned out. Lots of freewheeling, lots of pushing of the front, and then he caught him out. But nevertheless, he rode really well. And, you know, even Tom can take something away from this meeting to sort of encourage him for the rest of the season.
Yeah, no doubt. We also had something that we rarely see, and I think that you pointed out really well, probably a symptom of age, but the exploding wheel.
Yeah, and I didn't, again, I called that one completely wrong, because obviously they've got a single-sided Stringham, and we have seen wheels come loose before and riders pull in. We've never seen one actually drop off. I assumed that the wheel had come off. Now, it would turn out, and I saw pictures before we came away tonight, of the wheel completely smashed. I mean, it's ripped the middle from the spokes, you know. So, Berger was a little bit lucky, although a couple of times over the last 20 years I've seen that happen. It's always happened out of a slow corner, because obviously that's where most torque and strain is going through the spokes in the back wheel. So it was quite lucky it was Berger to get away with it. But, you know, I can only assume it was an old wheel. I mean, you don't know. You know, some of these teams, I see teams at BSB level, and, you know, they'll bend a wheel and they'll hammer it straight and balance it up, and you just think, yeah, sometimes, you know, wheels are stressed apart and you don't know when that's going to sort of come back and bite you on the ass, which obviously in this case it has.
Think back to your days, James, when we were putting things back together with duct tape and baling wire, dude. We didn't care.
No, yeah, you have a point.
All right, Super Sport. You know, that was a really fun race to watch. And frankly, I almost look forward to Super Sport sometimes more than I do Superbike. This year, perhaps not so much, but I have been extremely surprised and impressed by, in theory, what our 2009 Yamahas and the Park and Go team kicking ass. And this was kind of a chance for Chaz to come back after that horrible thing that happened to a bunch of guys with the tires down in Australia. But give me your thoughts. What do you think of the race?
Really good race. I continue to be impressed with Skasser. He's a good kid. He's raced well everywhere. He raced well in AMA. He's raced well in Super Stock. He's raced well in Superbike. And he seems to have gelled really well. We just wondered whether he was too big to get to grips with the Super Sport. He's a big, chunky lad, Skasser. But he's the man to be. I was really, really pleased for Chaz. I thought he deserves that. He's riding the Yamaha really well. Like you say, they've got good bikes. They're not the newest bikes out there. But then again, the Honda isn't a new bike. You know, they're all bikes that have a couple of years behind them as models now. Disappointed for Sam Lowes and for Ellison. I thought they were both riding well. It would appear that it's the clutch on both bikes that's gone. Now, that team, the PTR, well, it's the Bogdanka and the Park Algar team. It's both run out of the same garage, same engineers, and same development team. They don't have that many breakdowns there. They're a very, very professional team, possibly the best for my money in the class. Both riders went out with a clutch problem. Now, it would appear they've been developing, along with Elf, some low-resistance oil that's given them they're at 16,000 RPM. It's giving them about 2 brake horsepower. But it would appear there's been some issue where the oil's broken down, and that's what's blown the clutch out. So, you know, bad luck to them. I thought that Sam Lowes, having had 3 crashes on Saturday, always said he was going to start slow and build up. Now, he had put three quickie slaps to the race in just before he broke down. Whether he would have had time to catch Davis and Scassa is debatable. He says he definitely would, and he would have got quicker, but he had 3 seconds to get up to him, which is it's a big gap when you're only pulling 2 or 3 tenths a lap. But, I mean, again, for Ellison and Lowe's, very disappointing, but lots and lots to be taken away from this meeting for encouragement. I mean, notwithstanding the fact that for the Parc Algar team and Lowe's, it's a big mountain to climb now if they're thinking about the championship, because sure, they've been quick enough everywhere. Fastest lap both Donington and Phillip Island, nearly got the win. Phillip Island could have definitely been on the roster at Donington, but you know, when you're up against that, the Yamaha team, the Pack and Go Yamaha team, and Scassa and Davis looking like they are, you know, you can't afford to be getting DNFs.
Yeah, no doubt. But, you know, you're right. You know, Mark Woodage, Simon's certainly going to be looking at people askew and saying, well, come on, guys, let's figure this out. But, yeah, it is going to be a difficult climb. Gino Ria, another good run. And I know that you said it, and this was I was loving it all the way through. Everybody's got to be a little bit scared, even though he's not quite on the top up running with the very top guys all the time. But that red helmet is up there again, James.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, he's a good guy, Israel, as well. They had a really, really rough run through qualifying and practice. They didn't really get more than about 4 laps together. 2 engine problems, both blow-ups, cost them a lot of time, didn't get back to the pits quick enough. You know, lost lots of time that way. Tyre issues, they changed suspension. I don't know why, you know, really don't know why. They look a bit disorganised at times, that team. They changed suspension completely to a different make halfway through qualifying, which is, you know, that can be a good idea. But he pulled something out of the bag, albeit with a little bit of help, with the, you know, the PTR bikes going out. But he rode well, and he's riding really, really injured. I mean, he's got his thumb in this contraption that you know, it's difficult to see how you'd ride a paddock scooter with it like that. But nevertheless, he's getting away with it. It's amazing sometimes, though, when you've got an injury, you know, how you work round it, and you sort of compensate, and you use other, you know, you use other bits of your body to sort of compensate, and different sort of theories, and you work around it, and that's what he's doing really well. I spoke to him afterwards. He's really pleased he got the result. Didn't think they'd end up in the top five, so he's quite buoyant. He actually said that, you know, he's surprised how much work, after being so competitive at the end of last year, he's surprised how much work still needed in the team to get it somewhere near every weekend. You know, he doesn't feel like he's a genuine title threat yet at all.
Yeah. Well, so that's interesting. So it came a little easier to him last year, but that's something to ponder. The other gentleman with the red helmet, one we never want to have around us.
Yeah, you mean
I meant Ray too, Rhea too, but Robin Arms, no doubt, one of our favorite riders.
Yeah, I must admit, you know, I have nothing against Arms at all. Tended to crash a bit, doesn't crash so much now, still looks a little bit loose, still you see odd shots of him coming back onto the track after, you know, off-track excursions, and he's a busy little rider that always looks like he's trying probably 10% more than his ability, you know, would sort of dictate he should. But, you know, who can knock a man for that? He's quite popular. People like him. He's a tattooed little sort of wrestling type. You know, he's a little wiry fella. And, you know, good luck to him. He's always there and thereabouts. And I don't think they've got so much money to spend. You know, I think it's a fairly budget team. So, you know, good luck to him.
Yep, no doubt. All right, Super Sport was big fun, but we were getting on to the final race of the day, or at least World Superbike race of the day. And this, you knew this was going to be a bit of a nail biter, because I at the end of race one, I was saying to myself, Max is going to be livid over the results. And if anything, it took a turn for even the worse. And, you know, the term lost the plot is one that it does come to mind. But this was the one where he kind of seemed to fall apart. And in a way, there were things about that really bothered me, but it kind of showed me a side that is not going to be working well. The racing itself, though, was fantastic. Give me some of your thoughts. Obviously, the jump start right off the bat. Boy, you called that, and you weren't going to let that one go.
Well, to be honest, I saw it. I'm actually looking at him. I mean, the bike's that garish coloured, you can't really miss it. And I know it's gone, and I know it was a definite jump start, but it just never got organised. They call it quite well now. Now they've got the proper electronic sort of line equipment. And I didn't see how they could not give him a ride through. You know, and they did, and that's fine. But again, another example of just how rattled Max had seemed to get all weekend. And I think even the slapping of Verlander, you know, was an indication of maybe a little bit of pressure. And I don't know why he felt the pressure there, but, you know, he seemed to be on the back foot all weekend. And in race one, he ran wide four, five, six times, looked to be pushing too hard. And race two, as you said, didn't get any better. And again, not coming in for his ride through and then getting excluded. And it's just all a little bit sort of not the professional. You would have thought a man with his experience and obvious talent and speed would be, you know, acting like that. But yeah, he was out of the way. For me, Checker got the result and rode the way that he seemed to be capable of all weekend. I mean, he's been quickest every session and looks settled. And, you know, we went out watching down Craner curves, and it's like plunging off a mountaintop, his Craner. You've got a lot going on. The bike goes light. Both wheels are kind of drifting. You can't put too much power on because the rear steps out. You don't really want to show up and load the front. And it's all, it's quite complex what's going on there. And we've watched of everybody. Checker comes down there and he's faster than everybody, and the bike is nailed to the floor. And you know, that's it. It's a good sign. Where he was making all his time was from Redgate around to Coppice, the fast flowing accurate part of the track, you know, and he didn't do so well, or he wasn't as much quicker than anybody around the sort of stop start scratchy Melbourne Loop Goddard section. But who cares, around the lap he was quicker, and I knew that if he could have a couple of laps on his own, he'd get away, and that proved to be the case. He went for the softer tyre in the second race and played it perfectly. He eased off when he had the time to do it. When Melander was catching him, he controlled the race from the front, kept the time going, and even though Melander was lapping a little bit quicker towards the end, it didn't matter, he'd done the job.
Yeah. In fact, Carlos was one of just many that actually made the switch to the soft, wasn't he?
Yeah, but when we saw that three or four people had done that, in my mind, I was thinking probably Carlos is the only one who will be able to make that thing last because of the way he rides and because of the way the bike is set up and looks so stable and smooth. If anybody was going to get the best out of that tyre that was going up towards the end, it would have been him, and that proved the case. Again, a little bit disappointed for Leonard. And what we didn't see on screen is he was off the track at Coppice because he had this huge eyesight where some glitch in the electronics. He said he just behaved differently that lap, flicked him out of the seat. He landed on the screen, cut his neck as the screen broke, went on the grass and got back. And he raced really hard to get back to fourth. A bit of a damage limitation. But Aslam's that sort of rider that will always get the best out of a bad situation. You know, he'll never give up. And he always surprises me. Just, you know, he's down in fifth or sixth or seventh, then suddenly you see him in the back of the shot and he's coming. And, you know, and he's that kind of sort of terrier-type rider. Melandri, again, really impressed. Didn't get going as early as what he should have done if he was going to catch Checker. But, again, very impressive.
Yep. And certainly glad to see Leon Camier up there. We had some concerns going into the weekend about his health and if he was going to be able to stay in it, and it was great to see him on the box.
Absolutely, yeah. He deserved it as well. He's been through a lot lately, this glandular fever thing. He's not allowed to do any testing. The doctor doesn't even want him racing, but obviously he has to race and he wants to race. He said it wasn't actually his fitness that made him suffer, that he was suffering for at the end. It was the fact that the tyre, both races went off quite badly and quite quickly. You know, different bikes wear different tyres at different rates, and he's went off. He said mid-race, he thought he had a good chance at beating Melandre, and just three laps after thinking, yeah, I'm in good shape, he knew he wasn't going to get anywhere near him. You know, it was damage limitation. So he did really well. He had a good result. I saw him as we came away just before I got to my van, and he was, you know, really pleased, really sort of quietly sort of smiling and having a cup of tea, and it was a good result, really good result. And I said to him, in fact, you know, if you've just been watching telly and sitting on the couch and not training, you want to do a bit more of that, because I haven't seen you ride this good for a long time. You know, he had a good result.
Yep. Have you found out any idea why Smertz did not have the same pace in race two, or did he just wear himself out in race one?
I don't know. We couldn't really figure that out. We didn't speak to anybody, but there didn't look to be any sort of big changes made to the bike. He went with the same tyres. It didn't look to be doing anything silly. We didn't hear stories of any, you know, electrical problems or clutch problems or, you know, the usual things that we have read now when people go fairly steady. It's normal, you know, traction control issue or a corner entry issue or they have a problem with a clutch or whatever. None of that filtered back, but he just didn't seem to get into it, you know, but that wasn't usual given his pace in race one. But that's what can happen, you know, two races in the day, you know, it doesn't generally go that they're both the same, so it's a bit odd. And, you know, maybe he just didn't make the start, got a bit rattled or got hemmed in or whatever, you know, but certainly once he got out on his own in race one, he looked the part as good as the team. I mean, he finished second, he was really pleased. It's the best result him and the team have ever had in Superbike, but you've got to feel sorry for him. He was out at 3 seconds. At one point, and then, you know, didn't win. So, yeah, good result for him. He's a good bloke as well. He looks like a vagrant. He's got that kind of beard that isn't really a beard. He looks like, you know, he should be living in a cardboard box underneath a sort of railway bridge, you know, but he's a good bloke. And well-liked in the paddock, he's cool, but he's, you know, he's well-respected and liked by the other riders.
Yeah, he's got a great smile, too.
Yes.
A couple of other guys that I was wondering about, one Ayrton Badabini, because he actually had a good run, but Tom in race two, any idea why he was lagging back a bit?
He just said he was out on number two bike because number one was more badly damaged than what they thought. He'd done a lot of damage to the electrics and smashed the seat rail off it. He just said the second bike, the number two bike, didn't feel the same, didn't get confident with it, and although essentially the same seconds were sort of dialed in, it felt a different bike, and that's how it can be sometimes. Normally, when it's like that, you know, I've been out on the number two bike. I remember I blew a Ducati up in Central, I think, on my way here once, in the warm-up, no time to change, jumped on the second bike. It felt bloody awful for about three laps, but you normally ease in to what it feels like, and then you get to grips with it. But it's a lot different now because these bikes are so complex, compared to what I was used to, you know, electronically and everything. You know, if it isn't feeling right or not doing the right thing, especially when he said it was quite unpredictable, you know, out the way the corner entry system was going to work and the way the traction was working. You know, if it's the back of your mind, if you don't know what's going to happen exactly, you know, even if it's not doing something right, if it's doing the same thing wrong every time, you can work around it. If you don't know when it's going to do something or what it's going to do each lap, you're a little bit stuck, you know, and he said he just never got to feel comfortable with it.
You know, we'll carry on with next run as Aston. And Badovini, a bit of a surprise. Shouldn't be, but was a bit of a surprise.
Yeah, it shouldn't be. But like you said, a really good race for him. We know how good this kid is. He's really good. He doesn't fall off. He learns and he stays on, and consequently his confidence gets, you know, doesn't get a battering. And the team is really, really organised. It's quite a small team. They're always parked next to and garaged next to the main BMW Motorrad team. But I've got to say, it looks just as organised. It's not a bit more organised. It's a really kind of condensed but efficient-looking bunch of lads, you know. And, you know, that show today. You know, that BMW is so quick as a standard bike. It's not that difficult. Even a super stock, you know, BMW spec engine, you can make produce, you know, 205 or 206 horsepower. So sure, it's always going to be quick. It's the way the team works then to give the bike the rider the bike that he can work with. And Badovini's a good kid. He looks like a kind of you know, like a real swatty kid at school with the satchel and the glasses. He kind of looks like that, you know, the one that'll never be good at any sports, really, or get sand kicked in his face on holidays on beaches. But he works well, and he doesn't crash. And that, you know, that level is a good thing.
Sure. Yeah, but those were the kids that always went on to make all the money. Near last question, but I'm a huge Haga fan. I cannot. I can't be anything else. And I'm kind of watching this thing, and, you know, I've got my moments to cheer, and I know that you probably had a chance to talk to Nori. Anything going on that front with you?
No, he looks, to be fair to him, he looks probably a little bit heavier than what he has done. He's put a bit of weight on. Not too much to make him, sure, you know, uncomfortable. He just looks kind of comfortable in himself. He looked a lot more comfortable with the bike, a lot more. He looked a fish out of water at Phillip Island. He didn't look to get to grips with it. He was moving around. He didn't look. When he's happy, you can tell. He rides with a fair amount of abandon. You know, he's sliding a little bit. The bike's moving. But you can tell he's happy with it and he's going to have a go. And he looked to get a little bit of his mojo back at Donington. He did. Quite encouraging, I would have thought. You know, I don't know how much help they're getting with the bike, but it looks quick enough. And he looks like, given a little bit of time, he may be able to get to grips with it. He's one of those riders, though, you can never ride the dude off, ever. You know, we've done that so many times the last 3 years. That's him, he's finished, he's had enough, his heart's not in it. Bang, he puts one in. So the speed's always going to be there. It's a matter of just sort of teasing it out in these days. But we were quite encouraged, you know, because a World Superbike Championship without Noriaga is, you know, I'm not saying it's going to be like MotoGP without Rossi, but it's, you know, he's a fixture and fitting. He's a part of it. He's a colourful part of it.
Yeah. Are you heading? So for you, this must have been a bit of a homecoming. You do PI and you're doing that remotely, but now you're home. You going to head off to Assen?
Yeah, we're doing Assen. We're doing six of the Europeans, so we're doing pretty much all the Europeans. We're going to Assen. Assen's a good one. You always get, I mean, it's nothing of a trip, you know. It's 2 minutes on a flight and a bit of an iCar run, so it's almost like a home round for the Brits. You get a lot of British interest there, but they're expecting a bumper British crowd there, because this year, especially, you know, first time in a lot of years, there's a real genuine chance of a Brit win. I know that Johnny Ray's won there before. You know, it's one of the places where Brits go well, and they're expecting lots and lots of people aired out on the bikes Glaston this year. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Well done. And that's April 17th, I think. James, I'm stoked. It's been a good start to the season. It was, you know, I stayed up for pretty much 24 hours to catch you guys through whatever methods.
Yeah, well, you know what? I was just going to say, mate, you still sound chipper. You need to get an early night now, mate.
I did. right after race two was done, I put my head down, which would have been 9 a.m. here. And I woke up because I said I was going to call you at 1 my time. I woke up at 1:05. I'm like, I better sound chipper.
No problem, mate.
All right, brother. Listen, I will talk to you soon. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us. And
no problem, Jim.
James, thank you very much. Great to have you, as always, on the show. And I know that you're a fan favorite. And very cool. Really cool to have him. I can't say it enough. Cool to have his feedback and information afterwards, and what can I say? Great stuff. We'll play in a bit the Lucio Petterchini interview, but in the meantime, we've got a couple of other things to talk about. Let's talk about Super Sport, Jules.
Yeah, is there so much to talk about there? I mean, it was the opposite of what we normally expect, right? The super bike races were really tight, cool races, and Super Sport was kind of a runaway. But it was nice to see the guys who actually made it to the podium.
Very true. Very true. And it's certainly a race that the Brits had an opportunity to, as well as all superbike races, to do well at. What are the notables? The notables are certainly a couple of guys that were expected, no doubt, to run at the front, that being both Sam Lowes and James Ellison, both running on the PTR Hondas, as you had heard and James and I talked about. Won't go into much detail there, and there isn't a whole lot, but there's no doubt that that team, especially with Sam running well up in the front, and frankly, with Gino Ria kind of trying to hang on by his toenails, he got gifted a bit there. So don't need to run down World Supersport. Not the best race of the year, and frankly, you never like to see anybody going out because of mechanical failure. And now, in two race weekends, both Phillip Island with the flats, the Pirelli tires, with their failures, and now we've got some mechanicals that are knocking top riders out. We don't want to see that at all. And it kind of takes away from the drama and suspense that we have in looking forward to a last lap or two battle. So hopefully,
you talk about Sam Lowes, right?
Yeah, both Sam and James, too.
That's right. And James actually almost made it to the end.
Yep. And but that being said, I don't want to take a single smidgen away from both Lucas Gessa. Brilliant, brilliant job. And frankly, super props to that team for taking a 2009 and push forward updated bike, as well as Chaz Davis. Both of you guys gave it your all. And Chaz, you need to go kick Luca's ass because he's way freaking taller than you. And both of you guys look like monkeys fucking proverbial.
They're both huge, aren't they?
They're huge. Yeah. And you saw that one picture that was.
Yeah. Came,
yeah. It's
Lucas. It's Lucas Gessa doing. You know. Yeah.
No, the thought that I had. Okay. The reality is that he probably got bucked out of the seat, right? And somebody caught him at an opportune time. The imagery that occurs to me is when somebody's running toward a pommel horse, and he looks like he's basically trying to vault himself over it.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
And then some of the commentary was great about the particular reason why he was doing that. In fact, some of it was closer than you might think. One of the things that you can do when you're tall, and I would have a very good idea about how to do this on a small bike, is you can actually help break the draft behind by creating, instead of being super super streamlined, is actually by raising your rear torso, or in essence, your ass, and creating turbulence behind you. And when there's turbulence behind you, especially on a lower horsepower bike, and I say that with a little bit of jest because most of these bikes are running between 145 and 150 rear horsepower. You do whatever you can. If you're a tall dude, you're breaking a lot of air and wind. Not
yeah, okay.
Realistically
keep going,
speaking.
Keep going.
But that
shot was actually in the corner, although he may be settling back in from like doing that. Maybe.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it's pure speculation on my part, but the frank fact of the matter is that these guys are both Chaz and Luca are really tall guys. And it gives me some inspiration for being a tall, skinny, near 4 year old that, I might be able to go back out. In fact, you know, I'm getting still pistoned by Ed Sorbo to come out and run that endurance race on April 23rd.
At Infineon?
No, at Buttonwillow.
Oh, okay. I was just trying to goad you into saying Sears Point. So the British anthem did not play at all during the weekend, which was kind of surprising. I don't know. I mean, I really thought Chaz was going to be able to take Scassa, but he wasn't.
You know, I think the one thing that kind of bums me out, and you mentioning the British anthem wasn't playing, was that, and walking into, given the field this year, I was pretty sure Triumph would probably get a win. And when contractually Park and Go couldn't work things out with BE1 and that team all put together, I was bummed that we didn't have Chaz and Luca, who were both supposed to be on the team on the 675.
Of course, given the way that that one bike blew up, you know, pretty much from the get go.
But still,
in classic Triumph style.
Yeah, and when was the last time the Brit national anthem was played for a manufacturer?
Oh man, you're right.
There is a trick question in an international road race series, either World Superbike, World Supersport, MotoGP, or any of the subclasses there, be it 250 GP, Moto2, or 125. Moto2 might be cheating. That's interesting. In Moto2, do they play a manufacturer's anthem on the podium?
No, because they don't do that in GPs at all.
Sure they do.
No, they don't.
Sure they do.
Mm-mm-mm. They do not. They do not play the manufacturer's anthem. They just play of course.
Fine, Bertha. You move on. Don't edit that out.
Okay.
Fine. All right. So, Supersport. Where are we going from here?
Well, you're going to play one more interview for us.
Ah, I will. Lucio Pedercini. Always love talking to anybody named Lucio. What a charming, charming man. When I originally talked to him, he was in the midst of a meeting with the Kawasaki brass, or Vertigo Green, if you will. No, Verdigris? How do you pronounce that word? Verdigris? It's when you take brass or copper.
That medication's kicking in, isn't it, Jim?
No. Dude, it's been a long day anyway. I'm probably laying on the charm too much. But and so he had to put me off, and he handed him over to Robbie. And then I said I'd call him back an hour later. And indeed, we did get a chance to have a talk. And he's a former GP racer. He was riding privateer Yamaha YZR 500s back in the day. So it was a good time to chat with him and take a listen to what he has to say in a relatively short interview, but good to get another voice. Run away.
Okay, this is Jim Race with Motopod. On the line with me, I have Lucio Pedercini of Team Pedercini. How are you, Lucio?
I am fine, thank you.
Great.
I am in Donington, so cold here. Very cold.
Yeah, considering that you had great weather or good weather for the past 2 days, today was very cold, and tomorrow is supposed to be nice, so not so bad.
Yeah, but, you know, we arrived here Wednesday, and Wednesday was very, very warm for this place, and also Tuesday and yesterday was wonderful, and today become England, so very cold and windy. The truck was very, very cold, also the rider was not so happy to ride with the cold condition.
So, certainly, and that makes setup rather difficult, and especially considering that you may have good weather tomorrow. Did that obviously that contributed to troubles that you guys had today? But are you going to go back to your Friday setup, you think, for tomorrow?
Yeah, you know, our problem now is in the winter we didn't test, so for us the bike is completely new and we have not experience, and especially with this condition, so we are still testing, and
sure.
we hope tomorrow. We spoke a lot with Robbie for tomorrow, and we changed something. And tomorrow morning, in the warm up, we hope to find a good setting for the race, like in Philippine, because also in Philippine, when until Saturday night we was not so happy, but during the night and Sunday was good in Philippine. We hope same here.
Sure, and when you look at, for example, the results that Tom Sykes is having, you know that there is promise in the bike. And what do you think, because you've been working with Kawasaki for a bit, what do you think of the 2011 ZX-10?
Sure, the bike is very, very good. You know, I told you before, our problem now is we didn't test. So, you know, it's not easy to test during the race. Because
sure.
The rider think on the time, and so it's not very easy to work in this condition. But sure, the bike, we are very, very happy, because when we change something on the bike, you feel the changement. You know, if it's better or worse, you feel. And with the bike, the 2010 bike, many times you change it, but he didn't feel the change.
Sure.
So that was the problem.
Yeah, the ZX-10, it seems, up until this year, always had issues where it had plenty of power, but the handling was an issue. So you mentioned, yes, that you haven't had the opportunity to do testing, and doing testing during a race weekend is difficult. Is that primarily down to trying to acquire sponsors? I know that money is tight right now.
You know, that is the big problem in this moment, because here in Europe is very, very hard to find a new sponsor, and so you know the racing is it costs too much, and if we can get more sponsor, it's possible to testing more, but
sure.
without the sponsoring, it's difficult to test. Because the truck is so expensive, the tire, everything is so expensive. So it's not easy in this moment.
Absolutely. Well, you have to be able to look at the field at least and say, okay, we're fairly close, and like the top 10 or 13 are all within a second. And so the racing is very tight.
Sorry. You know, there is the angle for closing.
No problem. Yeah. You're right next door to Midlands Airport. So you have to be happy that the field is at least relatively tight. There's not a whole lot separating the top from the bottom.
No, you know, I am happy because I am very I think we can do a very good job this year. But we knew also we received the bike in January, so it's not easy because not too much time. You know, last month we was in Phillip Island and we have no time. But I am very confident to be maybe not in Assen, but for Monza, I think we can. Our championship can start from Monza, I think.
Sure.
I hope.
No doubt. Hey, I want to pull you back to your own racing days a little bit. You were racing back in the early 90s, and I know that you had a couple of championships with the Italian series on board a Ducati. Do you still have a spot in your heart for the big twins?
You know, I am the rider with the most start in the World Superbike Championship because mm-hmm. I made 177 races with Ducati, just with Ducati.
Right.
So I rode just Ducati. For me, it was very, very good bike. And I can't tell you because when I had an accident in 2006, from then I stopped my career and I never ride the four cylinder. So mm-hmm. I don't know very well the difference from twin and four cylinder. But sure, for me the Ducati was my life because I ride for 9 years with Ducati 996, 998, 999. So a long time.
Yeah.
I used the actually 6 years in World 500 Championship in MotoGP.
True.
MotoGP. Not MotoGP, but GP.
Right. And you were on a...
I think I am lucky because I start to race with the legend of the racing rider like Kevin Schwantz, Wayne Rainey, Randy Mamola, Freddy Spencer, because I started in 1992. So
right.
Wayne Gardner, Doohan, many riders. And for me, I can't believe that. Also now, if I think 20 years ago, for me, it was a dream, you know? And I'm lucky.
Yeah.
Also, if I was a private rider, but I was in the truck with that rider. And for me, it's fantastic. I'm a lucky guy.
I seem to remember, I think I may have met you in either 92 or 93 at Laguna Seca.
93, I think.
Yeah, 93. We were both a bit younger back then.
Yeah, I remember 1993 because it was my first year in Laguna Seca and I loved the truck because it was fantastic. And I had a problem to the start because in the turn turn four, I think,
mm-hmm.
the second ride, one guy touched me on the back and I crashed it the first lap. But during the practice, I was faster with the Rocky Yamaha. I love that truck.
Yeah, I'll have to dig through some of my old pictures and see if I can find some of you. I'll send them off to you. I know that you have some work to do tonight. And you also need to get some rest, but I did want to have a chat with you, and I thank you very much, Lucio.
You're welcome, and call me when you want.
Okay.
I'm happy to speak with you, of course.
Great. Best of luck tomorrow to you and the team, and we will talk to you soon.
Lucio, many, many thanks, and hopefully we will get a chance to meet in Salt Lake. All right, so many, many thanks for downloading the show, as usual. Also, very, very cool for everybody to be mockingly joining us on the Motopod fan page on Facebook, and for writing in and calls, letters, emails, well, except for you people that actually find my phone number. That's a little creepy. And Jules, I'm looking forward to the race at Jerez this weekend. And as you mentioned, hopefully we'll have somebody on the ground. If not, we'll still have plenty of information and interviews. I am stoked. And I'm also kind of bummed because now we get to figure out what our sleep cycle is and isn't. And
I know, exactly. That's what I'm thinking.
I know. What time is it? I got no idea. I don't even bother to set my watch. And thank God, I guess both of us have relatively forgiving bosses.
Yes. And yeah. And I have a very forgiving spouse because she watches the races with me. So that's what...
Well, you keep an eye on that. Make sure that continues. I think that's good for us. And we will talk to you guys next week.
All right. Ciao, man.
Later. I want to go there someday and take a crap in a bucket.